Hello, this is the podcast for October 27. It's class number 19, and today we finished up our discussion of the cause of action for negligence. We haven't talked about damages, and that's required, of course, but we'll keep that separate. That's not a particularly substantive talk. So what we finished today was duty, breach, cause, in fact, and proximate cause. We also started the little section on defenses, just a little bit, affirmative defenses. But this, that's not going to be an exam. You're instructed on the midterm not to write on defenses. I just wanted to start this section so we can not get behind. But please, what we talked about at the end of class on affirmative defenses is not, it's not part of the midterm exam on Monday. Anyway, so when you're going through these proximate cause questions, try to put them in some sort of category. Is there something that was unexpected about them? Was it an unexpected extent of injury? You expected a physical injury of some sort from a rear ender, but all of a sudden the injured party dies of a heart attack. Then V. Thomas. The courts will very frequently allow some very unexpected types of injuries when they result, extensive injuries when they result from a impact upon a person. Is there an unexpected type of injury? That is, oil spills, you think it's going to seep into your dock and suddenly it gets ignited and your dock burns down. That's polemus. Polemus rule, anything that results in the direct consequence of the initial negligence. If any injury was foreseeable and the injury in polemus was rotting out your dock from spilled oil, then all injuries that flow in a direct consequence fall under the scope of the risk created by that negligence. The only way in polemus where there was a where the injury would stop would be if there was a negligent intervening force that superseded the original injury. But that negligence has to come after the original injury, the original negligent action on the part of the defendant. Wagon mound, change that a bit to add on the theory of foreseeability. That is, the type of injury has to be foreseeable. Not, you know, remotely foreseeable, but foreseeable, that is, a foreseeable risk of the negligent action. So that if it falls under the scope of the risk of the negligent behavior, if it's foreseeable. That's our rule in Wagon Round, our rule in polemus. It falls under the scope of the risk created by the negligent behavior if it's a direct consequence of the negligence. So foreseeable result of the negligence. Again, you use the facts to determine that. Of course, you have to, the judges in these proximate cause cases, since they're very much policy-based, the judges take a much active role in deciding how much evidence or if there's any evidence that to send this to the jury. The jury determines the foreseeability. It's a jury question of fact, but lots and lots of policy rules get set down by the court. And many times the court will say, as a matter of policy, the jury can't come up with this. You notice in Ben v. Thomas, what was the problem there was that the jury hadn't been instructed on the eggshell skull plaintiff. The case got sent back to the jury. The court said, well, as a matter of law, we can't decide whether he was eggshell skull, but here's the rule on this. And jury, you decide whether, as a matter of fact, our plaintiff falls under that designation. We move on to Paul's graph, which has taken to be unexpected plaintiff. That is the plaintiff, was the plaintiff someone who fell into the scope of the risk created by the negligent behavior. And this is a very, very narrow way to look at proximate cause. Most jurisdictions are going to say, if somebody's injured, you can't say they fell outside the scope of the risk created by your negligence if there's a physical injury. The narrow way to do is to do to look at whether that plaintiff, that particular plaintiff, was foreseeable because of the either some proximity question, some question of where they were or the time in relationship to the original negligence. There are some examples in the book about the negligence occurred, injured somebody, had a brain injury, and 20 years later, as a result of that brain injury, the damaged person goes out and shoots someone because they couldn't control himself. Is the original negligent defendant going to be liable for that subsequent injury? And courts limit that unforeseeable too far away from the original negligence. So the unforeseeable plaintiff plays a role much more in our jurisdiction than in other ones, but Paul's graph has come to stand for this concept of unforeseeable plaintiff. Of course, Cardozo talked about it in terms of duty. The plaintiff was unforeseeable, so they had no duty to him. He had to do that. He had to put the limitation on at the negligence stage instead of at proximate cause stage, because basically at the time, Polemus was the law, and Polemus would not have allowed for any limitation. Under Polemus, the only question of foreseeability was whether any injury at all was foreseeable from the negligence. If any injury at all is foreseeable, all injury that flows as a direct consequence then is falls within the scope of the risk. So Cardozo obviously didn't want to follow Polemus. He didn't think there was any negligence at all, period. But, you know, to a lower courts had found there was, so he got around it by limiting by a duty. This is, I think Andrews has it exactly right. There's no reason to limit by. There were plenty of ways. Any, as you all could imagine, she was a fee-paying passenger. The scale shouldn't have fallen. There were lots of reasons. Maybe not the negligence of hauling the Italians on board, but he could have limited, if he wanted to limit it, he could have limited it at reasonable care, that it wasn't unreasonable for them to haul the Italians aboard. Here he just shut down the duty entirely. So even though Cardozo famously talks about duty, this has been taken to be a proximate cause question and the foreseeability of the plaintiff. New York still continues to look at the foreseeability of the plaintiff. And you will see this, you know, always do question about foreseeability of the plaintiff. It's much more theoretically appropriate to bring in the plaintiff's foreseeability at the question of duty, at the question of proximate cause, than it is at the question of duty. Remember in Doe v. Mannheimer, the court didn't talk at all about foreseeability of the plaintiff. This is a Connecticut court, and foreseeability of the plaintiff is not at issue there. It would have been at issue in New York. They care more about that. And Doe v. Mannheimer, remember, it was an unforeseeable type of injury based on the wagon mound foreseeability for proximate cause for type of injury, but they kept it at a very narrow type. in Dovie, Mannheim, remember, sorry, that under the Posakai rules, they found that there it was criminal activity on that in that area was foreseeable. There had been plenty of it, but under the foreseeability rules for proximate cause, much more of a narrow definition of foreseeability. And they said the exact type of injury has to be foreseeable, not the general type, the exact type. Even though they say general type, it means they're not applying it in that way. So we saw, and then we talked about the Kinsman cases where they looked at foreseeability of the particular plaintiff and the particular injury from the viewpoint of all of the three different defendants. And they took a more of a proximity view to the city of Buffalo and the owner of the Sheriff's. They should have known it was foreseeable that there was going to be damage. If they negligently didn't lift the bridge or negligently moored their boat. For the dock owner, it was a harder thing. They clearly said it wasn't foreseeable. This kind of injury wasn't foreseeable because the negligence had been in operation for such a long time. Nevertheless, they said that because it was direct, so they did kind of a direct, a little bit of a direct consequences. They included liability against the dock owner. Again, don't get yourself all twisted around you making that decision whether something is foreseeable or not. What you want to be able to do is know the different rules, Palemis Wagon Mound, and be able to know what facts are available to the jury. Don't just say it's up for the jury. You have to know the relevant facts. Are there enough facts to send this to the jury, or are the rules so overwhelming that no jury could find otherwise? And we have rules of foreseeability. Rescuers are foreseeable. Negligent rescuers are foreseeable. Subsequent medical negligence is foreseeable. So there's certain rules. Eggshell skull plaintiff, that's a rule. That is a policy question that can take it out of the jury's hands or can be just given to the jury along with the facts, and you have to know what the relevant facts are to determine whether there's enough play, enough facts, both pro and con, to send this to the jury. So classify, if you're looking at these things, be sure to identify what the negligent action is. Classify, because in order to classify what falls within the scope of the risk of the negligent behavior, you have to identify what the negligent behavior is. So first, get your duty, get your breach, get your causation. Then, if there's something that is more attenuated than the exact injury that you would expect, then start looking at the negligent behavior and what's within the scope of the risk created by that negligent behavior. Did the negligent behavior put an innocent plaintiff in a position they wouldn't have been otherwise? Very much liability. Did the negligent behavior create a risk that was unforeseeable, or was what actually happened just within the scope of the risk as a direct consequence of the negligent behavior? All of those things matter when you're trying to analyze these problems. So, again, you have to identify what the negligent behavior is and identify what's unforeseen, what's unexpected by about these particular types of actions. After we finished talking about proximate cause, we moved on to a whole new discussion, and that's affirmative defenses. Now, this isn't on the midterm. Make sure you don't talk about this on the midterm, because we just started talking about it. You don't know anything about it at all. But affirmative defenses basically is a way of for the defendant to say, okay, I did it. I was negligent. I caused this. But, you know, the plaintiff was negligent too. So a negative defense would be saying, I didn't do it. I wasn't negligent. Affirmative defense was, I did it and the plaintiff did it too. The plaintiff was also negligent and had a role. And under our old system, pre-1970 system of contributory negligence, that would have been enough to get any negligent defendant off the hook. Any negligence on the part of the plaintiff that contributed to the injury was a complete bar to an action. And this was pretty harsh. So a defendant who was driving drunk, hopped up on drugs, blindfolded, upside down with his driving with his feet down Church Street, who hits the plaintiff who just happened to be jaywalking, the jaywalking plaintiff, negligence per se, violation of a statute, that's a safety statute, are completely bad acting. Negligent defendant would get off. No liability, no responsibility because of the very slight negligence on the part of the plaintiff. Contributory negligence was seen to be so harsh that over time, by statute or by court decision, jurisdictions changed to a system of comparative negligence. That is, the negligence of the plaintiff would be compared to the negligence of the defendant. So that there was not automatically a bar to the recovery, but depending upon the type of statute or the case, the plaintiff's case would still be alive. So, for example, if comparative negligence was adopted by case law, by common law, such as Lee v. Yellow Cab in California, it was pure comparative negligence. No matter how negligent the plaintiff, a plaintiff would still have a case against a negligent defendant. So under pure comparative, we were talking in class about, well, isn't it kind of luck of the draw? You can go out and the jury decides that, you know, if it's in a modified state, if it's in a modified jurisdiction, there'd be no case at all. Yeah. But if you're in a pure comparative negligence jurisdiction, you'd always have a case. You're always good because no matter how negligent the plaintiff, the plaintiff can still sue as long as the defendant had some role in the accident, had some share of the fault. So if it was common law, it was always pure. Two types of statutes, pure and modified, that is. The modified is not always will a negligent plaintiff be able to bring an action. Two types of modified statutes. 50-50 or equal to the plaintiff's negligence cannot be greater than the negligence of the defendant. So 50-50 or, you know, can be less than, but it can't be greater than. Or the statutes that say the plaintiff's negligence has to be less than the negligence of the defendant. 50-50 won't work. It has to be 49-51, 40-60, less than. So two types of modified statute, one type of pure statute. And under pure, you can always sue. Under modified, you as the lawyer had better be able to advise your client as to the strengths or weaknesses of that lawsuit before you go ahead. You have to know your jurisdiction in order to be assured that you're not going to get aced out at the jury, at the jury decision stage when the jury apportions fault or apportions negligence. They could easily apportion more negligence to your plaintiff than the statute will allow, and in which case, no suit. So next class, we're going to pick up talking about these statutes, bring the statutes to class, not next class, but a week on Wednesday, on the 3rd, when we pick up class, we're going to continue to talk about these affirmative defenses.